We have two guests for you on this latest episode of Soundtracking in the shape of director Nick Rowland and Benjamin Power, aka musician Blank Mass. The pair have collaborated on Nick's debut feature Calm With Horses, a visceral crime drama set in the Wild West of Ireland, starring Cosmo Jarvis and Barry Keoghan. Now, it's a remarkably accomplished piece of filmmaking, which also marks Ben's first extended foray into the world of scoring. Now, plenty more of that shortly. First, a word from our friends at Babbel. Now, given that you probably have a wee bit more time on your hands at the moment, now presents the perfect opportunity to learn a new language. Maybe you're attempting to homeschool like me and failing miserably when it comes to French, Spanish, or German. Or perhaps you just want to watch your favourite foreign movies, subtitle-free. Well, with its clear and simple interface, Babbel guides you through your learning journey in a funny and smooth way. It's designed to get you speaking your new language within weeks, with daily 10 to 15 minute lessons teaching real-life conversations through interactive dialogues. Lessons are lovingly created by over 100 language experts. Real people, not a translation machine. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, and the teaching method has been proven to be effective across multiple studies. Babbel is available as an app or online, and your progress will be synced across all your devices. Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6 month subscription with the promo code SOUND. Go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code SOUND on your 6 month subscription. That's babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code SOUND. And so to Nick and Ben, whose score for Calm With Horses more than stands up as an album in its own right. This is the opening cue, Violent Child. Congratulations on the film. It's absolutely beautiful. It's so great. The way it looks and the performances and just the colour palette of it. What was it about the story? And I know it's kind of derived from this short story that really kind of connected with you, and you were kind of, this is kind of where I wanted to go and what I want to do.
I was at film school, in my final year of film school at the time, when I found Young Skins, which is Colin Barrett's original collection of short stories. And Calm With Horses was like a 70-page novella, the sort of the centerpiece of this collection. And I just kind of fell in love with it because, you know, it has the skeleton of this crime thriller. But the thing that really stood out to me was I just really enjoyed being, as kind of nefarious as these characters were, they were funny and they were emotional. And I just really believed that they were real people, which is so... It's a very sort of simple thing to say, but I feel it's quite hard to find. And Arm, the protagonist, I just found he's introduced in a very amoral way, where he's working as an enforcer for this family of drug dealers, and he's introduced by beating up this guy. And but then you see this sort of sensitive relationship he has with his young 5-year-old autistic son, and that duality and contrast was the first thing that really sort of jumped out at me.
When you started thinking about, how it would be sonically? Because Ben, I know that for you, it wasn't just a case of writing score with it as well. You worked really closely with the sound designer as well, and making sure that the kind of whole film had this full roundedness to it as well. But Nick, when you were thinking about kind of how the film would sound, what was the kind of thought process and what was the kind of decision behind Ben and Blank Mass being the right partnership for the film?
So there was a lot of, you know, the short story had this, it's a very, objectively, it's quite bleak and brutal, yet there was a real sensitivity and kind of expressionistic, kind of melancholic tone to the story, which you get through the prose, which obviously you can't, it's hard to, how do you convey that over an adaptation in the movie? So a lot of it came down to the sound design and the music. You know, we took the decision to try and really limit the point of view very closely to Arm and to kind of be in his head as much as possible, you know, because he's a character that doesn't, he's not very good at expressing himself and he's often not saying much. So we would often use music and sound design to kind of articulate a kind of visceral sense of how he feels. And then in terms of working with Ben, I mean, I've always been such a huge fan of his. So I remember kind of, you know, several years ago when we were first playing around with bits of voiceover and bits of the script, and I would play Ben's music over it to try and find a tone to it and stuff. But I never really thought we'd actually get to work together. So it was a real thrill for me. I guess that it's a balance of tones. There's this, the crime thriller genre stuff, but there's also a lot of emotion in the story as well. And trying to find a sound and a score that could accommodate both sides of the story in a very sort of fluid way. And that's what Ben, I think, does so brilliantly.
What was actually kind of interesting was that Nick told me afterwards, you know, I sent through some original kind of sketches for like a couple of cuts from the movie, just in a kind of demo sense. And Nick told me that he didn't open up the files to listen to the music for like 3 days afterwards because he really wanted them to be good. And
that could have gone the other way, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then he'd have to tell me, you know, thanks, but no thanks kind of situation.
Yeah. Those would be the worst conversations to have with people, though, particularly, you know, when you say where you have that kind of like unrequited want to work with someone, and then it's like, oh my God, please let it be what I want it to be.
Yeah, that's, luckily I had nothing to worry about, and it was it's kind of in a similar way to, it's that cliche thing that filmmakers say, that the first time Cosmo Jarvis came into audition, you kind of knew straight away that okay, this is going to work. And it was very much the same when Ben sent through the bits he'd been working on, and that was really exciting because, you know, I'd always love Ben's work, and what I found really interesting is the kind of that melancholic, emotional, kind of gentle sadness that was just there in spades, and it was just so instant. Oh, okay, that's the sound of the film.
And what was it that you kind of connected with?
I was sent the script I guess there'd already been a cut made. I guess I came into the process quite late on, actually. So there was already, I already kind of had a palette in front of me, if you see what I mean, to kind of work towards. But I felt that, like, for me, this is the first time that I've worked. I've done small bits for film and things like that before, but never have I done a full feature length where I had to completely paint the picture with the moving image or whatever. So it was interesting to me. And I also thought that the characters are so well written here. I kind of reveled, you know, I was very excited by the challenge of actually getting in their head and kind of like presenting their world on such a bigger scale. And, you know, I fell in love with the story as well. You know, the sadness that Nick talks about really cut through for me when I was reading the script. So, yeah, that was definitely something that I wanted to kind of like try out for the first time. And, yeah, I'm really happy I did. Really happy with how it turned out. Nick did a great job, you know.
Had you started filming by this point?
We'd finished the main shoot, and I think we had a rough cut, but there was maybe like a couple of days filming left, or there was a few scenes missing. So I was able to sort of share a rough cut with a caveat of, oh, this is going to be different and that's going to be different. And it was the fun thing about it was because we designed the story to be, because it was so subjective, we could really go through the scenes in a lot of detail. And you know, for example, there's one scene that takes place in a nightclub, and Ben was able to, you know, create the music that's playing in this nightclub, the sort of the diegetic sound that the characters are hearing. But what was great is, although it's the track that's actually playing there, it also does the work of score and sort of changes and reacts to the drama that's unfolding. So kind of having that blending the environment with the emotions of the characters is a lot of fun. And then obviously with Mattis Ray, the sound designer, you know, working, the three of us working very closely on scenes like that, it was nice that Ben had come in so early that we could really sort of tailor and make it very specific to the edit.
Was a real beast, wasn't it? I don't know if you can really call that a cue. It's kind of like a sound. It's a bit of everything. It takes so many different twists and takes on so many different forms. That piece of music that lasts, I don't know, all in all, Nick, maybe 10 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, about 9 minutes or something.
Yeah, and it's like cues within a club track, within this sound design world. I mean, I believe that Mattis actually went away and he took the club track as well and he played it in a club as well. So it's like this three-tiered kind of like,
oh, wow,
process.
Oh,
I was really glad that actually when I first saw the first cut, there was obviously a bit of temp music in the club. And there are a couple of times within the film where they're using existing things, you know, in a diegetic sense. But I actually said to Nick on one of our first meetings, I really want to make this music for the club scene, because obviously, you know, a lot of the other soundtrack, most of it is very, it was a different practice to me. It's very out of my kind of usual palette, if you know what I mean, of sound. So it was nice to kind of throw something in there, which is maybe a little bit more kind of what people might be familiar with as far as Black Mass goes, you know.
You said the word environment sort of around there as well. And it, coming from a little fishing village in Scotland, I mean, there was so much within the story that I kind of was like, that kind of almost like physical energy that a place has, you know, and the soundscape of it in regards to how the music really kind of reacts to the atmosphere and the location and all that kind of thing, I think is so brilliant as well. And I wondered if that was a specific thing that you talked about, and about that being almost part of, or a character within it as well.
I partly grew up in Banff in Aberdeenshire as well. So
I mean, yeah, listening to you, you would never.
Yeah, share. I mean, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, like, I'm not a native, but
you should hear him when he's at home.
Really?
No.
5 minutes on the phone with one of his relatives.
But my mum still lives there, and I guess that's what I would class as home. And I guess when I was, you know, I've never grown up on the west coast of Ireland, but I, you know, being in Banff, I felt there was an emotional truth which I recognized, and I felt like I'd met a lot of these characters and been to a lot of these places, and not as many dodgy things are going on, but you wouldn't be surprised if maybe there were. So yeah, and I think we worked really hard to get a lot of the sense of place conveyed with the locations and the performances and the actors. So I felt like we got the authenticity we needed there, which allowed us for the sound, we could really focus on the emotion and the sort of the poetic side of the tone, I guess, rather than, because, you know, those early stages, you do go, oh, well, we're making a film set in Ireland. Do we need to use a load of Irish instruments? And, you know, there's that kind of, what are we sort of expected to do? And we like the idea of kind of the story's very rural, and it's, you know, it's isolated, and there's mountains and the natural environment around them, but kind of almost treating the story like an urban film and bringing an urban kind of sound to it, and that contrast was kind of exciting, I guess.
Yeah. Do you know what music you need and what you need to write, Ben, in terms of I need X, Y, and Z, or are you kind of feeling it?
I feel like actually we started off with, I actually kind of jumped in at the deep end actually, and I tried to write a lot of cues for the more kind of impactful moments actually straight off the bat. I always try and like tackle the most daunting thing first, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And they actually, they seem to form reasonably quickly, actually. I guess Nick and I must have just been on the same page, or he's extremely gifted at describing what he needs. Where a difficulty started was actually some of the much smaller cues that almost would seem incidental next to some of the more kind of bombastic cues, for want of a better word. They were ones that maybe we struggled with a little bit more, because they're so, I feel like some of them are so specific that it's actually kind of difficult to get this kind of sentiment across that you can't even really vocalize.
Yeah.
But I mean, we got there in the end, and there are some points in the film where we thought there needed to be cues, and maybe they just didn't. There just didn't need to be cues. Like I believe I wrote about 9 or 10 cues for the one particular scene where Heck is giving a speech at Charlotte's birthday party or whatever. And we really struggled to get that one right, didn't we, Nick? And then in the end, we just thought, well, I guess if we're struggling this much to kind of figure out what is right here, then maybe the scene speaks for itself and it doesn't need any musical accompaniment.
Yeah, I think I remember there was another cue as well. We were trying to sort of convey isolation and like, how do we convey that in the end? Just the sound of winds did that, or you know, something more minimal. Or, you know.
I think sometimes it can be quite difficult to kind of convey these things that are so subtle, especially from me, who, you know, historically, I just throw everything at the wall and then start to pick things away. So something like Nick is just saying there, you know, I mean, it's a different practice to kind of strip back everything in that sense. And yeah, there were some kind of things that maybe were just left to sound design as opposed to like musical cues, I think.
There's a couple of specific moments for me that I wanted to talk about. First thing I wanted to ask is he listening to anything on his headphones when he's listening to his headphones?
Well.
Originally, yeah. It's something that didn't really survive the edit process, but in the script, we had this idea that before he would enact violence or do his day job of being this enforcer, that he would have to kind of zone into it. So yeah, it would be part of his kind of pre-performance routine. And that was going to be echoed at a few different points in the film. It was kind of one of those things. It's like, I kind of never fully nailed what that would be. So it kind of, it still works as a nice introduction to the character, but the original plan sort of fell by the wayside a little bit.
Was Cosmo, it would be blank mass, surely.
Obviously, I was going to say, yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Was Cosmo listening to anything, though, whilst, you know, in that particular scene? Did he listen to much music in terms of, because I know that he, just from reading all the production notes, he very much kind of, you know, stayed in accent, maybe not so much character throughout the whole thing to try and really sort of immerse himself in, you know, in the culture of this character.
Well, the thing with Cosmo is he used to be I guess he still is a musician. Yeah. He's sort of, he seems to find a musical instrument anywhere. And yeah, he was always in character the whole time. He was always, you know, dressed as Arm and, you know, usually at the end of, I mean, because I only met Cosmo a handful of times in the auditions, and then very quickly he was Arm and became more solidified as Arm for the months that I knew him. And I kind of forgot who Cosmo was. And it was only when we got to the end of filming where we finished and he went back to his normal accent. And I was like, oh, shit, I've not seen you for a few months. And how have you been, sort of thing? It was so weird. But, you know, sometimes, you know, at the end of the day's filming, the actors, you know, usually get back to the hotel an hour or two before me. And 9 out of 10 times I'd walk into the hotel and I'd hear beautiful classical music being played on the grand piano in the lobby, and then I'd go around the corner and there's Cosmo still covered in fake blood and all the rest of it, just, you know, playing away. So yeah, it's and I think that's why Cosmo had, you know, his accent's flawless and he has such a good ear for these sorts of things, and you can tell he's got such a gift for that kind of stuff.
And the other bit, there's quite a few here, but the next bit was the kind of narrative element to it, and I loved how that was scored when he's doing the narration sort of side of it, and what the kind of, I guess, the, you know, the sort of themes, I guess, around characters and that, and whether that was kind of what you talked about, if it being almost kind of thematic in a way.
It was completely. I'm not sure if that's something that, it's definitely something that came out of we responded to it and we became very obsessed with themes with the music. And we like the idea, you know, old scores where the score and the themes are a real part of the characters and they're really memorable. And we like the idea that you could associate motivations with a piece of music that reoccurs in the film, or you can use a piece of music to link characters together.
And actions also. I mean, like, there's a particular cue that happens whenever Dimpner is manipulating Arm, and it happens at two kind of key moments. I was about to give a spoiler away then.
In a bus?
But yes. Yeah.
Once in a bus?
Yeah, sort of like an abandoned train and a toilet, and then somewhere towards the end.
Somewhere else towards the end, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
sort of idea though of scores that do that? Did you have specific scores that you discussed from, you know, old films that for you did that?
I don't really recall actually having any chats with Nick about, or at least making references to, other films which use a similar kind of like theme-based cue system.
Yeah.
It almost felt kind of impulsive and just to fit these scenarios and these characters to just go ahead and do it in this instance. I think it was kind of, it felt more intuitive to, as opposed to kind of wanting to like, not wanting to reference something, but use it as like a reference point, like moving in to this. So yeah, honestly, I feel like it was intuitive between Nick and I, actually. I'm not sure if maybe Nick had conversations with, you know, other people working on the film about this, but we certainly didn't, did we, Nick, really?
No, I mean, we always wanted, although there's a bleakness to the story, we wanted the film to be quite vibrant and cinematic, and, you know, there's comedy in it, and we wanted the world to feel quite, to have a sort of elevated ordinariness to it, and almost treat the story a bit like a Western, and for it to have quite an analog feel to it, because I didn't want it to be, the film to be mistaken as a piece of social realism or a comment on anything political or anything like that. We just wanted to create its own little world of this story. So with the mountains and the isolation, and sort of treating the town a bit like a frontier town in the Western, or, you know, the sort of spaghetti Western kind of vibe. Yeah. That's something we were always aiming for, to hit, for the film to have a kind of classical feel to it.
I think like the use of space as well, like that I ended up using in these cues in the soundtrack, you know, there is a lot of kind of empty space, which is just as important as like the actual kind of audible components, like within the cues themselves, within the stems of the cues. I do think that does mirror the kind of Western thing that you're talking about, you know.
There's a couple of other ones when Jack and Armour at the fair, and Jack's getting more and more kind of distressed, shall we say. That's an extraordinary piece and a really, really moving scene as well.
Yeah, it's one of those, a lot of those real emotional cues. I seem to remember we would talk about it a lot and talk about the scene, but then from my point of view anyway, it was very simple. You know, Ben would just send something through and it would just connect into something very visceral in your gut that was just exactly what we needed.
Had you seen that scene then, Ben, when you were, you know, were you reacting to that performance?
Yeah.
And that young kid that cast as Jack is extraordinary.
Yeah, he was five years old, a local boy. And I was very, you know, we were very lucky to find him. And also Element Pictures were our co-producers on the film. So very graciously, Lenny Abrahamson, who did such a great job with Room.
Oh, amazing.
You know, so he was able to sort of share some of his tips and wisdom. All those scenes we'd already shot. So it was kind of a lot. I seem to remember there was a lot of a lot of the time I would talk to Ben about, there'd be beats that wouldn't be quite clear, or motivations that wouldn't feel fully delineated properly, or transitions that would be feeling bumpy. And I'd spend days and days with the editors trying to solve these problems. And then often I would talk to Ben, and he would just do something very, very simple but genius with the score that would just either ease a transition or really clarify a gear change in a scene, or it would give a context to what Arne is thinking that would unlock the scene. You know, going back to the club again, there's at the end of the club scene, it cuts to a scene on the cliff. And it was so, because of it's a low budget film and, you know, resources are tight, and there was basically a scene missing between those two scenes. And I was really struggling to make that part of the edit flow. And the way Ben was able to, he kind of has the club track bleed into the score of the next scene, and it's a very elegant solution, and it became one of my favorite moments in the film. But it sort of was born out of me not doing my job properly.
No, I feel like we, just going back to the point you made before about did it feel like reactionary, I feel like Nick and I actually spent a heck of a lot of time actually kind of discussing or trying to figure out what sentiment we would want to portray within the score. And it would sometimes just come down to a list of words and sentiments, which we would narrow down to like shame or manipulation or something like that before, you know, I actually even turned anything on in the studio. So I feel like I actually came pretty well armed regarding the sentiments and stuff. But obviously, you know, having a cut of the film in front of you obviously is going to help, and you're going to obviously kind of react to the environment as well as the internal sentiment that you're trying to get across.
Yeah. What was it particularly then with that scene with Jack and Arm at the fun fair, Ben, that you kind of drew from that really sort of, I guess, inspired?
Well, I feel like it escalates, the whole scenario in that scene escalates. So I did want it to kind of reach a kind of climax, which is almost kind of overwhelming, but there is, you know, it ends up being shame and surrender essentially. I really wanted to kind of get like the surrender, you know, he knows that this is maybe the first time you see in the film, he knows that he's not capable of looking after Jack in the way that he should be, you know, and it's distressing for both of them. So I felt that, and it's obviously very sad, you know, and kind of panicked as well. I mean, the list could go on. but I feel like the escalation and the way it escalates so quickly, and, you know, there's an undercurrent of kind of like panic and sadness. That's kind of what we wanted to get across there. In fact, Nick, correct me if I'm wrong here, but that was a moment when I think I wrote that cue when you were up here, and I was playing around with it whilst you were here, and that was one moment where, like, both Nick and my, you know, our arms stood up on our hairs, our hairs stood up on our arms. and we were like, well, that's got to be a sign that something's working. Yeah,
it does. I mean, the whole film has a kind of real physical reaction to it, I think, as well. I love the car chase as well. I love a good car chase in a film. Nick, from reading the production notes as well, I believe it was something that you used to do professionally or just as a hobby, like racing cars?
Yeah, I used to compete in rallies. I was sort of
amazing.
I'm a failed rally driver, so I did that for
that's
a while.
One way, that's one way of looking at it. Or you're just one of those people who's good at everything. But
no, definitely.
Okay, favorite car chase in a movie.
Oh,
I'm going with Blues Brothers. I love that.
I guess I love you know, Steve McQueen's Le Mans movie. Yeah. I think that's pretty phenomenal. Yeah, so I'd done a little short film. My graduation piece from film school was about rally driving with Richard Madden and Michael Smiley. So I'd kind of done a low budget car racing scene before. So I kind of took what I learned from that and applied it to this film. We only had a day to film the scene, so we had to be incredibly economical. And honestly, there's only 3 or 4 angles in the whole chase because that's all we had time for. So a lot of it was, you know, just being very economical with it. And then a hell of a lot of the success of that scene is down to the sound design and the music and the way those things are working together. Luckily, Mattis, the sound designer, had done my rally driving short film as well. So we'd sort of had a good practice with it. But that sequence was one of the things that Ben sent through as an early sketch, you know, before we really started working with each other. And it basically stayed unchanged to my memory anyway. I think it's basically as it was. So that's just a case of Ben nailing it. And what I loved about it is there's it brings amazing tension to the scene, but it also, the rhythm of it made me think of like galloping horses and sort of tribalism and all this kind of stuff, which just fitted perfectly.
And complements that landscape as well that it's going through as well, like that Western thing as well you were talking about.
That screeching guitar. So yeah, it was that cue, wasn't it, Nick? It was the car chase, like the warehouse and the car chase, and then also like the main theme as well, I believe, was the maybe the first thing that you'd heard, you know.
Yeah, I was so happy with it that we hardly touched it. So when it came to actually the final mix of the film, I remember there was a panic where we were like, where do these files even exist? Because we hadn't, you know, that it was months since.
That's right.
So we kind of, and we only had like an MP3 of it that you'd sent me months ago. And then when it came to actually finding the stems, we were like, where is it?
I think it was because it pretty much stayed the same from when I sent in, you know, the demo cues or whatever, if you will. But the first day you were here, we were making so many slight changes, weren't we, to fit it. You know, just like slight variations on when things would fade in and when things would come out. And I guess I saved a bunch of different versions of it. And yeah.
Panic.
Won't be doing that again. All is good though. We found them.
Yeah, we found them.
There's only one place they could have been. They can only be on my machine. So
Ben, what's your favourite film, Car Chase?
I've never really thought about it, actually. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I'm not sure. I really don't know.
Were there any films particularly, Nick, for you that were like inspiration for you in terms of going into this production?
Yeah, quite a weird mix in a way. I think the challenge with Calm with Horses is in many ways it's a very straightforward story. What made it really complicated to make was it has quite a lot of competing tones. You know, you have the emotional family drama, the crime thriller, and then sort of offbeat comedy at times, and trying to find a language to it that would accommodate all of these things. And so, you know, early Danny Boyle work and early Shane Meadows was an influence, and then a lot of Jacques Audiard's work, I guess, as well, is I really respond well to. And yeah, I think trying to find a language that can sort of have a baseline of naturalism to it, but allow you to move into more expressionistic places, I guess. Yeah, so like movies like Rust and Bone were a huge influence, and Shallow Grave and Trainspotting, all those sorts of classics.
Yeah, and then that kind of, I guess, it's not the last cue, but when he's at the house waiting, basically, and the way that music's used, kind of over the phone call, and then. Oh man, I was in bits watching that bit. She's like,
that's good. That's good. I think
I needed a big cuddle after that. Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, Cosmo, it's a very simple way to end the film. It's basic, you know, it's an 8-minute long take just on his face. So, and we had no other coverage or no other option. You know, we made the choice that's how we were going to do it. And
brilliant.
I think that's take 7 out of 8. So yeah, and we knew Cosmo was going to nail it, because originally I wanted this phone call to be an audition piece, and Shaheen Beg, the casting director, was like, "You're cruel and evil for asking people to do that." So we didn't in the end, but Cosmo came in for his audition and prepared it anyway because he wanted to do it.
Oh my god!
You know, made us all cry, and so I knew he would do it, but I was still relieved. Really, how amazing he is at the end of the film. It's about I finding that balance of not wanting to be manipulative or kind of force an emotion down anyone's throat, and to support and help elevate the performance rather than, but still have confidence in the performance doing what it needs to give it the space it requires, I guess.
Yeah. Was it an easy 8 minutes to score, Ben?
Well, the majority of that scene is actually, there is no cue. And then obviously when it creeps in, I feel like this was maybe that whole scene was in the first cut that was presented to me when I came on board. And that one just felt in like very intuitive. Like, you know, everything is kind of coming to a close and kind of wrapping up. So I kind of impulsively, I just felt like I had enough to go on. Yeah. You want it to be sad, but there's also we also wanted there to be a hopeful element there too somehow. So I felt that one was, I just had so much information that felt like maybe one of the easier cues actually to work on.
Mm-hmm.
before I let you guys go, thank you, by the way, so much for taking the time to chat to me about this beautiful,
thank
brilliant
you.
Film.
Yeah, thank you.
What's next for you, Nick?
I'm
apart from self-isolation, obviously.
Yeah, I'm actually writing my next film at the moment, yes. Which is going to be it's going to be another crime thriller, but it takes place within the world of competitive rally driving.
Wicked.
That's what's next. Yeah.
Multiple car chases.
Yes. Yeah.
Ben, what about you?
I've got a bit of stuff going on here. Some things I maybe can talk about, and maybe some things I can't.
Someone in the next room actually said to send him a tune, so he's. Like,
yes, so I guess I'm just kind of trying to navigate this self-isolation thing, you know. I'm supposed to be touring right now, that's not happening, but yeah. I'm lucky in the sense that I can always find something to work on, you know.
Like you said earlier, you've done various bits and bobs with film, but this being the first kind of proper, you know,
yeah.
full thing. And what was the experience like? Was it what you expected? And does it make you want to do more of that kind of thing?
I mean, it's something that I've always wanted to do. And obviously it's just a case of, you know, making that connection and the right kind of thing to actually present itself. Because your first one is, you know, it can be a very intensive process. But I mean, I guess I was kind of spoiled because, you know, Nick is a joy to work with. So it all felt, you know, the creative side, all of it, it just all fell into place so nicely. And, you know, I want to do more. I want to do a lot more of this. It's been something that, you know, I've wanted to get my teeth into for a long time. So thanks, Nick.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And I we'll see. Watch this space. Yeah.
Before you go, can I get you both to recommend me a film to watch in this process of self-isolation, please? And silence.
Yes. Oh, gosh. I'm just trying to think.
The pressure.
I know it's. Do you know? I haven't actually watched any movies during this self-isolation.
Yeah. What
period.
Have you been doing?
I've just been in the studio.
That's good.
The whole time. Yeah.
I feel like comfort films. So, like, one of my sort of childhood comfort films is Empire Records. So I think something culty like that.
We watched The Truman Show with the kids last night. We weren't sure whether it was a 7-year-old appropriate, but we went for it anyway. 7 and 11-year-old. It was amazing. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Philip Glass soundtrack is crazy.
He turned around and went, "Is there another one?" And we're like, "No, mate, sorry, it's just the one." But oh my God, yeah, I'd forgotten how good the score in that is so.
Yeah.
Because it plays both, because it's the score of the TV, it's so in kind of weirdly twisted in those kind of, I guess,
it's beautiful.
Unnatural narratives. It was brilliant, actually. It was really, really great.
1.7 billion were there for his birth. 220 countries tuned in for his first step. The world stood still for that stolen kiss. And as he grew, so did the technology. An entire human life recorded on an intricate network of hidden cameras and broadcast live and unedited 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to an audience around the globe. Coming to you now from Sea Haven Island, enclosed in the largest studio ever constructed, and along with the Great Wall of China, one of only two man-made structures visible from space. Now, in its 30th great year, it's The Truman Show!
I actually really enjoyed the You Were Never Really Here, the Joaquin Phoenix, and that I thought that was an absolute masterpiece. And I only found out afterwards, I was like, I think the score is incredible, and then it turns out it's Greenwood, so that makes sense.
Yeah, Lynn Ramsey, amazing, absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Listen, thank you both so much. It's such a great film.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to see what you do either together next or, you know, individually. Particularly looking forward to the next the race car film as well, Nick. That sounds awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Can we watch your short film anywhere?
Yeah, I've got a Vimeo page, so you can probably just search for Nick Rowland and Vimeo, and I've got all of my shorts on there if you're bored.
Where I'm going.
Yeah, that's what I should have recommended. Yeah.
I recommend Slap, actually. I recommend Slap.
Yeah, okay.
That's a good shot of Nick's. It's amazing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care. Yeah. Thank you.
Score to You Were Never Really Here, as recommended by Benjamin Power. That's Joe's Drive by Johnny Greenwood, rounding off the latest episode of Soundtracking with writer, director Nick Rowland and Blank Mass. My huge thanks to the pair of them for taking the time to talk to us from their respective homes. Calm with Horses is available on home entertainment formats from the 27th of April. Make sure you stick a reminder in your diary. With Ben's score already out digitally via our good friends at Invader Records, it really is a cracking debut, and you can get it in vinyl format, I think, May time. Don't forget to check out Nick's short films on his Vimeo channel too. We'll stick a link to that up on our socials. Head to edithbowman.com to hear my chats with some of the directors mentioned, including Danny Boyle and Lynn Ramsey. And my website is also the place to subscribe to this podcast, though your preferred provider works just as well. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do keep an eye on our YouTube channel as we've just stuck up our first new episode of our weekly show. It's a little bit rough around the edges. That's because I edited it. Next up in isolation, absolutely thrilled to catch up with the fabulous Lenny Abramson, who has directed and executive produced Sally Rooney's Normal People for TV. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, stay safe.